This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last month, the Vermont State Employees Association presented a set of recommendations to the Joint Legislative Child Protection Committee. The recommendations outlined how social workers with the Department for Children and Families could stay safe, do their jobs well, and protect Vermont's children. On the issue of safety, social worker Tracy Casanova told us there's a direct relationship between caseload numbers and security, both social workers' security and the children they're supervising.
Social workers have great abilities in terms of engaging families and forming relationships with them in order to assess child safety and their own safety, and it's really difficult to do when the caseloads are so high, and it makes it almost impossible to be able to form those relationships and to do the proper background checks on people before going out and meeting with them.
Well, last week, Governor Shumlin announced a plan that would add 40 new workers to the child welfare system. It would send substance abuse counselors out with social workers to help address what the administration says is an opiate addiction-driven increase in families in crisis. The price tag is $8.4 million, and though the governor will come up with savings elsewhere in the budget he presents to the legislature early next year, it's lawmakers who will ultimately decide if the plan goes forward. And some advocates are saying it's not nearly enough to make a dent in the problem. Today on the show, I'm joined by Ken Schatz, Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, and Ann Pugh, Democratic State Representative and former social worker, who chairs the House Committee on Human Services and the Joint Legislative Child Protection Committee. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The strain on this system, the child protection system, has been going on for several years now, and one might argue it's always been a strain on the system. I mean, it sort of is by definition a difficult spot in Vermont and for families. But with the dramatic increase in the number of children who have been coming into state custody over the last couple years, it's been an even bigger pressure point. And it's been being addressed in various ways by DCF reorganization, by several committees who have offered advice and recommendations by the legislature in the last first half of the session. So why this new push right now? Ann Pugh?
I would say the importance of children and the importance of keeping children and families safe, and what we've been doing hasn't been enough and hasn't been working.
And will this new plan be enough?
It's a great step in the right direction.
Ken Schatz, you agree?
So I do think it is a very good step in the right direction. We're very appreciative of the governor's proposal in a particularly tight fiscal situation. In response to your question, I do appreciate the point that we've definitely seen this substantial increase in terms of reports of abuse and neglect increasing substantially. Our numbers of children coming into custody has increased substantially. We clearly recognize the need for more resources for our social worker staff. And that has been – it's not only our own assessment, as you pointed out. We've had outside entities reviewing our system. They've clearly confirmed that we must address the caseload concerns. And the reason for now is because we need to move forward. We really can't wait any longer. We've had, to be clear, it's been a process. 18 months ago, approximately, we added 18 social workers to our district offices and some central office staff. So now, unfortunately, the trend of caseload has continued to increase. And so in recognition of that, we've recommended and the governor has proposed this substantial increase in our resources.
Well, let's talk about what's in the governor's plan, and we can go piece by piece through some of it. $8.4 million is what he expects it to cost, and he says he'll find savings in other areas of state government, though the legislature is also looking to close a nearly $38 million budget gap this fiscal year and $60 million in fiscal year 17. So, Ann Pugh, do you think this is going to be a priority for legislators? Let's just start there. This additional resources for the child protection system, is that something that you think that the legislature will take account for?
It's risky to speak for the other 149 legislators. I would say it is a priority. Informally, I've had lots of phone calls from legislators from all political parties and not just people sitting on human services, that protection of our kids is really the state's first priority.
So you don't see legislators sort of saying, huh, where's this coming from?
I do not see that.
So let's talk about the number of additional staffers that are added in this plan. I think it's actually 41, right? So 3 deputy state's attorneys, 2 additional people in the public defender's office, 1 additional judge, and then the bulk of new hires will be in the Department for Children and Families. And that includes 28 new social workers. Can you tell me what concrete changes you expect to see from the addition of 35 new people in your department, Ken Schatz?
Sure. We will see the adding social work staff to every single district office so that we will have more staff available to help out with investigations, to make safety plans, to make case plans, to visit with children and their families. So on a day-to-day basis, we will see additional resources that will enable our social workers to do more and better work with the families and children that they serve. As was indicated in that clip that you put on in the beginning, I completely appreciate and support the notion that having lower caseloads will enable our social workers to have better relationships with the children and families they serve, which will both support better child safety and better worker safety. And so all those things are really important to us.
But how much will it lower the caseloads?
So the specific number is, if the proposal is approved, assuming the caseload basically stays on the same trend, it would get us to a place where we'd have an average of 16 families per social worker. Right now, that average is 17.7. So it is a significant improvement, although, you know, as Representative Pugh indicated, it's a first step. I mean, I would love to see the caseloads be even better. What we've talked about is trying to get to a place, you know, as the governor indicated, the dream is 12.
Because that's sort of national best practices. That's the standard for best practices.
That's correct. But it's also relevant to point out that we had an expert from Casey Family Programs who gave testimony to Representative Pugh's committee who talked about an average of 15 is also consistent with best practice, particularly if you bring in other support for social workers, which we've started to do in Vermont through case aids, so that we can support our social workers with other resources. In addition, as you pointed out in the beginning, we're also adding staff to help with substance abuse screening through contract with Lund. So those kind of support really would enable us to even with this improvement to an average of 16, I believe, to do better social work with the children and families that we serve.
Let me say here to our listeners, we'd love to invite you into this conversation. If you have experience in the child protection system, maybe as a family member, maybe you are a social worker, if you'd like to share your perspective with us, we'd love to hear it. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Commissioner Schatz, on that number, taking caseloads down from an average of 17.7 families per caseworker at any given time to 16 is what you anticipate, assuming that the pressures on the system stay about the same. Maybe you can help me out because, you know, if the dream number is 12 and you're going from 17.7 to 16, that just sounds like not much of a decrease in terms of doing things like what Tracy Casanova said, in terms of really getting to know the families that you're working with and helping both in terms of, you know, your interactions with the families, but also security and safety for social workers and for the families that they're dealing with. How does that make a difference to take it down from 17.7 to 16?
I think that it is helpful to recognize that it is an incremental step, that it will somewhat reduce the number of children and families that each social worker is working with. It will help them to focus more. I don't want to get overly dependent on just the numbers. Every family is unique. Every situation is a little bit different. Candidly, the number of children in a family and the presenting issues might make a big difference. What we look to is our supervisors working with their available staff to have an appropriate balance of some families that may have a smaller number of children in them and balance that off. And again, utilizing the substance abuse screeners and the case aids to enable them to do their job more effectively. So I think that, from our perspective, it's definitely a significant step forward. You know, it's not getting us even to 15 yet. But, you know, I think part of the reality here is we really need to address the issues of opiate addiction to actually get to a place where we're really doing what we really need to do to protect children. So that's kind of a big part of our focus here.
Yeah, and I want to address that because that is a very important piece of this in terms of how do we reduce the pressures and how do we make it so that it's not more and more children entering the system and more reports. But let me just pause and go back to this for one moment, because I agree with you, Commissioner Schatz. It's not all about the numbers, and certainly individual cases are going to be very different depending on the situation. So, you know, I don't mean to hammer on the numbers either, except that they're a proxy for us as we talk about the pressure on social workers and the pressures on families. So when you say it's incremental but it makes a difference, it's just hard to sort of understand exactly how much of a difference you really think it makes. I mean, if it's incremental but not very much, not that you'd ever say no to more money, but it's like all this hoopla for something that's not really going to make a change in the system, or is it really going to make a difference?
My perspective is it is, I mean, as you correctly said, we're not going to say no to more support. But this is a significant change. I mean, I think that when you think about the system, as you indicated, 28 more social workers added to a system that currently has approximately 180. That's actually, if you look at it in that context, it's a fairly significant increase of resources. And so if I think about it that way, I think about it office by office, and we'll allocate new social workers to office based on the caseload at the time. But it may mean 2-3 additional social workers to some offices. I think that will feel like a significant change for our staff, and hopefully, you know, our clients will see the positive impact of that increase in resources.
Representative Pugh, weigh in here. Both you've worked in this field in the past yourself, but you've also listened to all of this testimony. I mean, you chair the Joint Legislative Child Protection Committee, so you've thought a lot about these issues. Do you think this plan, should it move forward, will make a significant difference for Vermont families and for DCF workers?
I think, excuse me, I think one of the important aspects of this plan is that it is not just adding social workers. It's also adding the screeners. It's adding judges and other people within the legal and judicial system. Because protecting children and keeping families together is not solely the job of the Department of Children and Families and Family Services. So I think that my hope and belief is that the addition of the social workers paired with a focus on community-based services will in fact make a difference. I might argue that if all we do is increase the number of social workers, but we do not increase the ability of families to get to the services that they need so that they can parent their children or so that their children can be safe, then we're not doing our job.
And do you see that in this plan, or is that something you anticipate adding more into when you get into the...
I see it partly in the plan, in the use of the screeners.
Mm-hmm. These are opiate addiction specialists who would go with the social workers on family
visits. Or substance abuse in general,
yeah.
Professionals. Yes. Come January, I would not be surprised if the recommendations of Human Services is to increase or see how we can do a better job with our community-based services that include alcohol and substance abuse and opiate treatment, but some of the other really important services and supports. We can't just focus on the kids. We have to also focus on the families.
That's what we're going to talk about when we come back. We're going to look at these underlying issues that are putting this pressure on the system and how we can and should and are and aren't yet addressing those issues, including substance abuse, including services, including poverty, which is a factor in many of these cases. So we're going to talk about that. And we've got a lot of you who are weighing in, so we'll take your comments and questions as well. Our number, if you'd like to share a concern, a question, a thought, advice, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking about Vermont's child protection system today and additional support that could be going into it, as well as a proposed $8 million injection that Governor Shumlin has announced that he thinks might help relieve some of the pressure on the system. We're talking with DCF Commissioner Ken Schatz and State Representative Ann Pugh, a former social worker and chair of the Joint Legislative Child Protection Committee, as well as the House Committee on Human Services. So what are your questions? Are you a social worker in the state? How much will it help to add these 28 new social workers to try to lower caseload pressure? And what else needs to be done to actually reverse the trend of an increasing number of children entering the system? What supports need to go beyond Department for Children and Families into our communities, into our family structures to help people who are struggling? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. EM says the massive spike in drug use in Vermont has direct correlation with more children taken into custody, but many of those removals are in fact temporary and the family is reunited once unsafe situations are rectified. We do need more social service workers on the ground and just to simply process paperwork. Is that a part of it, Commissioner Schatz, that the paperwork and the sort of bureaucratic parts of this are putting a strain on the system?
You know, that's certainly a factor, but not the primary factor. Our social workers are really incredible. It's, you know, they're dedicated, committed. The challenge for them is to really do the work with the children and the families, to really look at the issues regarding safety, to look at what, I appreciate the point, how can we get permanency for that child? Can that child be safely reunited with their family, or do we need to be looking towards other permanent alternatives? I don't think it's not to say that isn't a part of it. And in fact, in the proposal, there are some clerical positions that we did include in the proposal. So we do need to recognize, yes, there's that need too. But again, another thing that I thought of listening to that question was foster homes are another big piece of this puzzle, that with more children coming into custody, even if it is only temporary, we really do need more foster parents. Again, we have great foster parents all over the state, but we need more. And particularly, we need more foster parents who can work with very young children, because that's another changing dynamic of the population of children coming into state custody.
Representative Pugh, do you have thoughts on how to encourage more people to be foster parents? That's not something you can legislate. I mean, that's a choice that individuals make based on a variety of factors. But how should the state be encouraging more people to be foster parents?
I think one of the ways that works for encouraging foster parents that may or may not be possible in this time period is to be able to offer them the supports and the connection so that they have someone that they can turn to. Foster parents do it for the most part, out of a commitment as opposed to a financial benefit. I'd have to turn to Ken. It's been a long time. But last I knew, on regular foster care, as opposed to a specialized foster care, it costs more to board your cat and dog during vacation than what we reimburse or provide as a stipend to foster parents. And with the multiple costs that go along with raising a child, that may not be enough. So I would say two things. Besides doing what they're doing in terms of publicizing it and talking about what you get from being a foster parent, and not financially, but what you get in terms of an individual and family and how having a foster child can, in fact, enrich your life. But in addition, these other two factors.
We got a question from Aaron in Thetford who says, I'm a guardian ad litem in Vermont, and we work closely with DCF to support the children who find themselves in the middle of a long court process while their family is being assessed and offered services. I wonder if any part of the $8.4 million expansion will go to the guardian ad litem program to keep our volunteers well-trained and supported.
So there's not a specific provision in the proposal that I'm aware of that goes to guardians ad litem. The judiciary is getting some additional resources. It is possible the judiciary may allocate some of that. The guardian ad litem program is run through the judiciary. But I have to say I do really do appreciate the question because they are an integral part of the system. We have actually been working in the CHINS working group that has been created as a result of Act 60 and have recognized we need to do more cross-training and provide more support to guardians to help them do the work that they volunteer for.
Let's go to a call from South Hero. Hi, caller, and you wanted to stay anonymous. Can you tell me why?
Because I work for DCF.
Okay, so what's your comment?
I just want to let the community know that the system for DCF, I believe, is in crisis. I'm a former employee also for New York State CPS, and comparing the policies between the two, I would say Vermont system is currently in the dark ages, and it's frightening to me. And also, with these number of workers, it's what we're talking about is putting a Band-Aid on a gaping, bleeding head wound on a system that's in crisis where the turnover ratio is extremely, extremely high. After there were the two deaths two summers ago, I believe there was a comprehensive study that stated we needed 40 more workers just to get the average caseload of the rest of the nation. And that never happened. So I'm not sure if these are new hires on top of those 40 that were recommended 2 years ago, if it's just a satisfy the current open slots.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think would work? If you could control the purse strings and allocate money where you think it's needed and resources, what would you think would actually work?
It seems very clear to me that child welfare is not a priority in this state for its people or its legislators. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in crisis.
But again, let me ask you, what would you do?
I imagine there's tons of pork. I would try and eliminate all pork and hire 60 more workers, 100 more workers. It's like a tour of duty for these workers out there, which is why the turnover ratio is so high, which makes it increasingly difficult for workers to form relationships with families.
Yeah, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. You know, there have been calls, Commissioner Schatz, that say in some of the reports, the independent reports that we talked about before, that said the number of workers that need to be hired is significantly higher than we've heard in any of the proposals, certainly higher than 28, maybe 40 to 60 more people total. So this 28, as we've talked about, will start to lower caseloads, but certainly won't get us there. This caller is saying it's not a priority. If it was a priority, if child protection was a priority, we would find a way to make those 60 new hires. Is that right?
I would say that I do think the governor has indicated that it's a priority, again, recognizing the fiscal situation the state is in, by recognizing that a year and a half ago, we did add the 18 social workers in the districts, and now we're proposing another 28, so that we are definitely, I think, making it a priority to add new positions to government, which is not been otherwise the practice over the past 2 years. So we are dealing with child welfare, I think, recognizing the significant needs that we have. I do appreciate the perspective, though, that we should talk about, can we do more? Can we do it in other ways to try to address the ongoing needs? So I do appreciate those concerns. And I think we want to keep moving forward. I do think that again, this is a step in the right direction.
Representative Pugh, you must hear this from people who say, there's a lot of lip service paid to how we need to protect our children, but if we really, really wanted to do it, we'd find the money. You know, as we're finding this $8.4 million, we'd find more than that. We'd find a way to actually stem the tide. How do you respond to those people who say, people say the children are the most important asset we have, and then they don't feel like they're seeing the actual reaction that would suggest that that's true?
It's hard for me to answer and talk about that question because on some aspect, I agree. On some aspect, I do. I believe it is a priority. And I believe in terms of when you look at other issues that the state is grappling with, the fact that the governor came out even before the legislative session started and even before he presented the budget adjustment to the Appropriations Committee. But he said this is a priority. That's huge. A governor has not done that in a very long time. I don't want to say for how long because then I'd make a mistake. That said, it's not just the legislature is a creature of the state of Vermont, and Vermonters have multiple priorities. I would like them to be children and families and ensuring that everyone is able to participate fully in Vermont's society, which is the realm of human services. That's not necessarily the priority of all of Vermonters. So I would say there is some truth to what the caller has said. At the same time, there is a growing awareness, and there has been over the past 2 years, of the importance and the fact that we need to do things differently and we need to change what has happened.
When we look at actually sort of stemming the tide or reversing the trend of more children going into state custody or being under state supervision, it's more than just hiring more social workers, as we talk about every time we do a program like this, because the social workers are trying to address a problem that has already been created. So for both of you, where do you see the best solutions is a hard word because, you know, it's not like you snap your fingers and put some money somewhere and you're going to fix the problem. But when we talk about things like economic stress, which is a huge factor in families feeling stress or not having access to resources that might help them with their families and with their children, opiate addiction, a big one that we hear about all the time, and certainly in terms of sheer numbers, one that's reported often as a problem for families who are dealing with abuse or neglect. So beyond adding additional staffers to DCF in terms of social work, Commissioner Schatz, what do we actually need to do to get the problem under control so that we're not addressing it once it is a problem?
Clearly, opiate addiction is one of those things that we continue to need to talk about and address. I think, you know, the governor did take the initiative 2 years ago of identifying as a major problem. We've certainly seen some improvements in terms of resources and access to treatment, but we still have a ways to go. And we certainly talked about that last week. The reality is we need to get to a place where there are no waiting lists for people who are wanting to get treatment, because it's got to be important to enable them to connect when they're ready and willing to do so. In the meantime, I think we need to give some more thought to whether or not if we can't go that far in terms of eliminating the waiting list, because there's all sorts of other issues related to that, do we want to make it a priority for access to treatment for families with children involved in the child welfare system, to recognize that particularly because of the children involved, that should be a priority. And so we need to keep working and talking about addressing the opiate addiction issue. I do think that has made a significant impact on the increase in child custody. I do agree that economic factor is definitely a concern for many of the families when they get involved with the Department for Children and Families. The reality is we need to also keep addressing those things in a variety of ways. On the one hand, we have a relatively low unemployment rate in Vermont, which is great, but we also recognize that many of the jobs people have don't pay families well enough to enable them to support their family in a comfortable fashion. You know, one of the advantages of the Department for Children and Families having a broad array of programs is we can talk about our workforce development programs through our Office of Economic Opportunity, through our Reach Up programs, and through our Office of Child Support. And we're doing all of that to try to improve the situation for Vermonters. The legislature gave us the authority beginning as of July 1st. We enhanced eligibility for Reach Ahead, increased the child care subsidy availability for families. So we're doing some things to try to address those economic issues, and we need to keep working on them.
I want to get one more call in here from Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Can you go quickly? You there, Susan?
Hello?
Hi. Yeah, we're running out of time, but I wanted to make sure I got you on. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted the listeners to know, and I have a question for the people on the show, about a completely different model of foster care that exists in Germany and apparently has an incredible track record of the kids after 18, both going to college and getting good jobs, rather than the U.S. and England, where the outcomes are really quite dismal, is my understanding of it. And I was wondering if that would be something that you would be open to exploring to develop in Vermont.
Susan, thanks for your call. Representative Pugh, you know, we talked about some of the different factors here. So addressing opiate addiction and some of the factors that lead to child abuse and neglect, addressing how we actually deal with child abuse and neglect. But what about the children who are coming out of the foster care system? In many cases, as we've heard over the years, although some of the monetary ties are a little bit better now than they used to be for children who are aging out. But what about helping kids who have been in the system succeed in life?
If we can improve their ability to go to college or some kind of post-secondary education, that will be huge.
Should that be free college, paid for by the state?
That would be wonderful. Don't know whether that's feasible. There are other barriers besides the cost of tuition, because many schools will, in fact, offer financial support. But it has to do with where are you going to live during the six-week vacation between semesters? How are you going to pay for your books? How are you going, you know, various pieces like that. I'm not familiar with the German program, but anyone who has good ideas about how we can do things differently, we're all ears.
Well, and we'll put contact information up for both of our guests today. We've been talking with Ann Pugh, who's a state representative, and with Ken Schatz, commissioner for the Department for Children and Families. Thanks to both of you for having this ongoing conversation with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the nation's first female combat engineer is a UVM student and Vermont Army Guard member. We'll talk with her next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At the end of November, the Vermont Army National Guard announced that one of its own had been awarded the specialty of combat engineer. This was notable because the specialist in question, Skylar Anderson, became the first woman in the nation to attain that distinction. UVM student and Army National Guard specialist Anderson joins me now. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So tell me exactly what a combat engineer does.
So a combat engineer really just works with mobility, countermobility, and survivability. Survivability deals with explosives. Mobility and countermobility, it depends. For mobility, we're moving from one place to the next, so we're building bridges. And for countermobility, we're breaking down those bridges.
Why was that a specialty that you were particularly interested in?
I never really decided to join the Army to be safe. My original MOS was a fire directional specialist for rocket systems. So I was field artillery. And so when this came about for combat engineer, I really decided it's probably the best way to go for me.
Why?
Because it's not really that safe. I mean, you really have to pay a lot of attention to detail. And that's something that I've always like really loved to be doing. I love just to go out there and make sure no matter what, I know what I'm doing and I can really do well doing it.
So there's that attention to detail that appeals to you, but you've now said twice you didn't join to be safe, or safety isn't something that you assume is going to be part of your job with the Guard. So is there something about that that appeals to you? Is it the adrenaline?
It would be the adrenaline, just to know that one wrong error, I mean, anything can happen, and you could either lose a limb or you can lose your life. Or in that case, if you don't pay attention to detail, someone else can lose their life because of you.
Which is terrifying to most people. Why is that not terrifying to you?
It is, in a way, a fear, but it's more of the fact if you do find something and you are the one that moves it out of the way, it's more of a rush, really.
You had to pass a course to get certified as a combat engineer. When you were first taking the course, you've told the press that you didn't know you'd actually be the first woman to be certified. But when you took the course, the combat exclusion policy hadn't been completely lifted yet. That was actually lifted by Defense Secretary Ash Carter just last week. So even once you were certified, would you have been allowed to serve in the role of combat engineer? Was that one that was already cleared for women, or would you have had to have waited?
That one was already cleared. Most of the MOSs that were defined as combat were not allowed to women, but some were allowed. It was kind of like a trial before he opened it up.
So that one was already allowed when you took the course. You knew that you could actually do this.
Yes, the course actually opened up August 1st, I read.
So when all the news has come out and now you've been interviewed for national outlets, you're being interviewed here, other local ones have picked it up. What does it actually feel like or mean to you to be the first female combat engineer? Is that something that's important to you or more of a distraction?
It is important to me. I always want to be a role model. It doesn't matter like who I'm a role model for. It's really like my little sisters, they look up to me and I want them to feel like they can do anything. They don't have to follow my footsteps, but if they put their minds to it, they can overcome anything.
So when you reflect on Ash Carter's announcement and this lifting of the combat exclusion policy so that all areas of the military are now open to women, what does that mean to you?
It means that women can actually come out. I feel like some were hiding and feeling that they couldn't overcome some boundaries that were placed on them. I feel that standards were put and it was more of a overcoming for some of people. So in my like defense here, I want to say that standards, if you can meet them, then you should be able to do it. For me, I did not want to be treated any differently when I was in North Dakota. So
That's where you did your training for the combat engineer.
Yeah. So I wasn't treated any differently. I was treated just like any other guy that was there.
What's your hope for your military career?
I just want to keep pushing forward. I'm not really sure where I want to go yet, but hopefully it's lives up to where I am now.
You're also a UVM student, and so you're pursuing a degree. What's your degree in?
Right now I'm doing an undergraduate degree in animal science for the pre-vet program for equine studies.
So you hope to be a horse veterinarian at some point?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, what are your career aspirations in the civilian field?
I do want to eventually become an equine vet. It's really inspiring to me actually to do athletic training for horses. So working on a racetrack or working on a rodeo side or something like that. But also maybe being an oncologist and working with the bones of animals as well.
So how do you see those two facets of your life tying together, your work with the National Guard and your civilian career aspirations?
They don't really tie together. I like having the best of both worlds. I love going to the military and being in uniform and serving the way I want to serve. But then on the other side, I can come back and be a kid per se. I can be a college student. I can be a daughter. So I like the fact that I can do both instead of having one life and living it that way.
And you plan to do both for a while?
Yes, I do.
That's Skylar Anderson. She's a specialist with the Vermont Army National Guard, and she recently became the first female combat engineer in the nation. Congratulations, and thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Cadwallader grew up in South Burlington, and he started his musical career in the South Burlington High School Band. That career path took him to New York to attend the Manis School of Music, and then to Texas, working in administration for the Youth Orchestra of San Antonio, and to the Los Angeles Philharmonic in educational programming. His musical odyssey has now brought him back home. He was recently named the new executive director of the Vermont Symphony Orchestra. Cadwallader sat down with VPR classical host Kari Anderson to discuss his vision for the VSO and to talk about the state of classical music in the country.
What are American orchestras really facing right now?
It all, to me, kind of centers around audience. And
The word audience can be the people that sit in a hall and listen to an orchestra performance, and it can also be the community. And that, to me, is the hallmark of what a really great, innovative, forward-thinking orchestra offers, is the way that they respond to the communities around them, as opposed to doing what they do kind of in a vacuum or being bound by the past. This is the way we've always done things, but really listening to and responding to their communities, their audiences. And that's something in LA that the CEO talked a lot about, the artistic imperative and the social imperative, and that these are not two things that exist in silos, that these are two things that feed each other and strengthen each other. And that was really revelatory, to think that, you know, when we are working in the community, when we are training young musicians, we're training people that could sit in the orchestra or that could take our jobs someday as administrators, that will develop a love for this art form and someday perhaps come and sit in our halls. And I think it comes down to audience.
So thinking about this idea of the orchestra as part of the community, who's really doing great work, bringing people into the hall and coming out to where people really are.
There are a couple great examples. And I think the first one that comes to mind for me is Cleveland. Their CEO, when he was hired, I think it was about 3 years ago, he made this wildly audacious claim that the Cleveland Orchestra will have the youngest audiences in the country within 5 years or something like that. And everyone kind of quietly snickered. And then he did it in 2 years. And it was amazing. And there were a number of initiatives that he rolled out. But I think it focused around students, around providing free tickets to students, not discounted tickets, free tickets. And its beauty is in its simplicity. I think there are other ways, of course, we can think about how we present our art in ways that are more creative and more engaging, but just simple and immediate. Offer free tickets to students and develop relationships with the people that get those students together. I'm thinking about the Vermont Youth Orchestra. There are two other youth orchestras in Vermont. There are colleges with music departments. There are schools with vibrant music programs. These are students like us that already love music and that just need to be shown access to it, shown the door. The other thing I'll say is in Indianapolis, it's called Happy Hour at the Symphony. And it's exactly what it sounds like. I think their partner is Dos Equis. And they have these wonderful receptions. It's kind of like it's a date night. The orchestra concert is kind of the centerpiece of what is a complete experience, a whole fun evening. And that, again, is the type of thing that draws people in. And it's less about showing up to a place, sitting in a chair, experiencing art and then leaving. It's a complete experience that really connects you in a very personal way with the art on the stage in a way that's kind of like, oh yeah, this is actually awesome. I want to do this again.
You mentioned audacious claims. Any you're going to make for the VSO right now?
I haven't yet finished 2 weeks on the job. And so in my first certainly 30 days, I'm focused really on learning as much as I possibly can. I know that it's important to make informed decisions. And in order to make informed decisions, you have to know how the organization got to the place that it's in now. And to be clear, we're in a great place. The thing that I think for me really resonates in a really positive way is that the orchestra is at the core of the institution's identity, right? And from an artistic standpoint, the orchestra is in a really, really healthy place. So to your question about making an audacious claim, I'm not going to make some wild audacious claim now, but I will say that what I mentioned earlier about audiences is something we're thinking a lot about. How do we fill the house? And in my mind, audiences that come to a show kind of break down into three categories. You have your traditionalists. These are people who come to concerts regularly, who are familiar with the standard repertoire and are used to the standard repertoire being performed in a traditional setting. And then you have the serious listeners, which are music nerds like you and me, who have extensive CD collections and are, of course, familiar with the standard repertoire, but also are open to alternative ways of experiencing classical music. And then you have what I call the progressives. And these are the people who are not familiar with classical music, who have not necessarily studied classical music in school, who don't know the standard repertoire, but they're open to it. These are people that maybe see live music at higher ground, that typically are younger. And this is the subset of the audience that I think we have a real opportunity here in Vermont to strengthen and to grow and to build. That really is going to be an early area of focus for us, for the whole team, is how do we fill the house? You know, we've been to concerts where it's a full house. The air crackles when you have a full house and when the applause starts and people people leap to their feet. You know, everyone from the audience members to the musicians on the stage, everyone feels that, and it's magical. And we want to bring that here.
Well, I love the idea of fostering that sense of curiosity about seeing live music, and what a different experience it is to really be in a hall full of people who are just really into what they're hearing. Yeah. Well, Ben, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Kari, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
That was Ben Cadwallader, the new executive director of the Vermont Symphony Orchestra, and he was speaking with VPR Classical's Kari Anderson. Now, it might be the most difficult conversation to have, talking about death and dying. Two residents of the Upper Valley started that conversation with each other via email, and their correspondence has just been published. We'll speak with the authors about how people can talk more openly about death and dying, not just wills and advance directives, but really opening a whole conversation about death and how you think about it in your own mind. So send your thoughts about death to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then listen live tomorrow at noon. I also want to let you know you should mark your calendars now. Next Friday, the 18th of December, is our date for the annual music show on Vermont Edition. We're going to be talking about the best music of the year as chosen by you. It is always a rocking good time, but we can't podcast it, so you have to listen at noon or 7 on Friday, the 18th of December, and we need your help. So send us your favorite song of the year. Just tell us the artist and the title and a little bit about why you like that music, what it means to you, what it represents, or why you think the artist is fabulous. We'll see if we can get a little clip of the music and play it during the music show, and we'll talk about all of the music we loved in 2015. Send your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance today from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show. This theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.